Today is December the 2nd, and so you know what that means? It's 23 days to Christmas. Oh, man, isn't it funny how that brings moans? Oh, you know, and you know why it brings moans is because everybody who's moaning has not even thought about what they're buying anybody for Christmas yet, right? Or maybe it's because of who's coming to your house at Christmas. I don't know which it is. Hopefully it's just you're behind on your shopping list and all of that. But Christmas, you know, when you're young, and today I'm kind of want to start us thinking about as we march towards Christmas on the 23rd and 24th in our worship gatherings. And we try to always at those very special worship gatherings, Christmas Eve and the day before, we just try to slow things down, kind of simplify things and have a time that we gather together as the church and as the people of God to just really remember who Jesus is and what it's all about, right? But leading into Christmas is not always usually simple. And what's ironic about that is that when you're young, Christmas is extremely simple, isn't it? I mean, you think about it, Christmas, when you're young and when you're a kid, it is incredibly simple because, I mean, as I thought about it this week, Christmas really, when you're young, is about two things and two things only. It is about wish lists and waiting, right? I mean, that's all Christmas is about when you're young. It's about wish lists. What do I want to get for Christmas? What do I want to have? And waiting for that to actually show up. Wish lists and waiting. That's all it's about. In fact, this last week I was reading an article about something. It had a link on the side of a funny wish list that kids have. You know, and I clicked on it. It was kind of interesting looking at some of the things kids write Santa and ask to get for Christmas. You know, I got a couple of them on the screen I want to show you. Just a couple of a very, what I mean when I say wish lists are really kind of simple and all of that. It's all about wish lists and waiting. I love this kid's, right? At the top of the list, he just wants cash, and specifically $200. I mean, I like this kid. He's direct, right? This is what I want. But then he asks right underneath that he wants dinosaur bones, in parentheses real, dinosaur claw bones, parentheses real, right? He wants a Labrador retriever, that is. He wants a second hamster. He wants a snake, and at the bottom he wants rocket boots and a jetpack. This kid's got like a diverse little deal. But what I really love is how he signs it. Nathan's list part one. Part one. So I really wish I could have read what part two was. But the bottom's the best part. He says, "Don't let me down." With, I don't know if that's a demon or like a zombie with fangs. And I guess that's Santa Claus's blood hanging off of his tooth, right? I'm thinking if that's your kid, you're calling a counselor for Monday morning or something. Like, I don't know. It's a little bit scary. This next list, though, I love what this next kid says. He has a whole list of things that he wants for Christmas and, you know, a red bouncy ball, a toy Mario, a toy worm, a toy dinosaur. I don't know what it is with dinosaurs, but they love dinosaurs, right? He goes on and on throughout the list, but my favorite part of this is number 12 out of 12 items. He wants a book about potatoes. All right. Good for him. But when you're young, I mean, Christmas is simple because, again, Christmas is about those two things. It is about wish lists and waiting. That's all it's about. Here's what I want. Here's what I'm wishing for. Here's what I'm hoping to get for Christmas. And then I'm waiting to actually get what I'm wishing for Christmas. But when you get older, the older you get, that simple Christmas gets a little more complicated. For example, when you're young and you're single, you know where you go on Christmas? Wherever your family goes, right? That's where you go on Christmas. Then you get married. Not quite that simple, is it? Because wherever you go when you first get married, somebody's mom's going to be mad about where you are, or at least a little unhappy, a little less than happy, right? So I read about recently, or a while back, I guess it was, I read about this couple that before they got married, they decided, and I think it was actually the wife's idea, before they ever got married, they put together a list, and this is where we are going to be for every holiday. And if you want to be with us, we'll tell you where we're going to be and who we're going to be with. If you want to see us, you just come here on those holidays. And then I read it, and I thought, that sounds like a brilliant idea, right? I mean, there's no controversy that way. There's no questions that way. You know exactly where they're going to be. And they wrote this list and they gave it to their family and they actually published it in this article. And so here's their list about where they're going to be, when they're going to be with her family, when they're going to be with his family. They are going to be her family. Here's the list of where they're going to be for Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, Labor Day, and the 4th of July. Anybody see any potential conflicts there? But his family was not to be left out. They had some special holidays of their own. Here's when they're going to be with his family. Halloween, Groundhog Day, Earth Day, Columbus Day, and Arbor Day. I didn't actually know that families got together for Arbor Day, but anyway. That's the deal, you know, when you're young and you're single and life's and you're not very old, life is a lot simpler, and Christmas isn't all that complicated either. And the older you get, I mean, it just gets a little more complicated the longer you get, right? And for men, Christmas is complicated. It's really complicated, especially when you're that guy and you've gotten married. You know why it's complicated? But ladies, I went ahead and plan on saying this, but let me just give a little holiday Christmas gift advice 101 here. It gets complicated for us as guys and husbands and dads because you ladies will say things like, when we ask, what do you want for Christmas? You'll say things like, I don't know, I don't really need anything. And if you say that, and I'm serious about this, we're not smart enough to know you don't mean that. And if you tell us you don't want much for Christmas, we're liable to show up with not much for Christmas. And it's just complicated, all right? So just tell him, no, I want a brand new diamond ring. And then we know, well, we can't do that. We got to figure something else out, all right? Just help us along. We're not all that intelligent. But anyway, it goes from being simple to more complicated. And one of the reasons I think Christmas gets extremely complicated the farther we get into it is really for one reason, life, right? I mean, life just makes life more complicated the longer you live. And it certainly makes the holidays and it makes things like Christmas more complicated. Here's what I mean. About 20 years ago, some of our best friends from 23, 24 years in the world, we've known them forever. My wife actually was roomed in college with this with a wife in this family, and they were in our wedding and just known them a really long time. And this couple, great couple, godly couple, love the Lord, following Jesus, they had tried for 8 years to have children and were unable to have kids. And the year we were starting the church, they actually found out that year that they were going to have twins, not only have one child, but have two. And it was this amazing deal and thanking God. And right before we started the church, we started November and October. The twins were born November 1st. We had the church started about the middle of November, right before Thanksgiving. They found out one of the twins had this rare genetic disease and probably would not survive very long. And in January, he died. And so how do you, in the midst of a season when we're supposed to be celebrating God's goodwill towards men, how do you do that when life throws you that kind of curveball? I mean, it's hard, right? I mean, you might still believe it, but you're finding it very difficult to actually celebrate it. Yesterday, I was officiating a memorial service for a gentleman, a larger-than-life individual who was older and retired and was celebrating with his family. He'd gone through some sickness and disease towards the end, it was just a lot of pain and a lot of very difficult physical things that he was walking through, and he passed away. And we celebrated his life yesterday in this memorial service, and the families gathered and sharing stories. It was really a very amazing, worshipful, and celebratory time, even through tears and pain and heartache. But the fact is, when you look and try to reconcile things like that with things that Jesus said, like, I came to give you life more abundantly, sometimes it's hard to reconcile those two things. And the older we get, it's not just that Christmas is more complicated than wish lists and waiting, it's that life's a whole lot more complicated than all of that. And trusting God sometimes in the midst of those seasons is not as easy as it once was. It doesn't mean that you're a Christian and you no longer believe in God and you no longer trust in God and you're no longer following God, but the fact is sometimes it's a little more difficult to trust and to follow and believe with sincerity and to trust and follow and believe with passion and excitement because life just gets hard, right? And so what I want to do today is I want to kind of address that idea, but I want to do it through a story at the beginning of the Christmas story that kind of actually precedes the Christmas story directly. It's a story of a guy named Zechariah and Elizabeth and the son they would one day have known as John. Because when you look at the story of Zechariah and Elizabeth, I think there are some amazing parallels to sometimes where you and I find ourselves in the midst of life becoming a little more complicated than maybe it once was. Luke chapter 1 is we're going to be today. So if you have a Bible, I invite you to turn there. If you don't have a Bible, hopefully there's one underneath the seat nearby you, page number there on the screen. But we're going to be in the Gospel of Luke. And what's interesting to me about the Gospel of Luke is Luke was not a guy that walked and hung out and spent time with Jesus. Luke's a guy who says, you know what? I want to find out what is true and what is not about this guy named Jesus. There's a lot of talk about him, and he's undertaking this account to find out what is true and what was not and what people saw and experienced and what they did not see and experience. And he writes this account that he got by interviewing basically eyewitnesses to the life and ministry, death and resurrection of Jesus. And he puts all that together in this. And here's one of the very first stories that he tells in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 1, verse 5. Here's what it says. It says, in the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah, and he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth, and they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren, and both were advanced in years. I'll stop there for just a second. So here's what it says about this couple. First, it says that in the days of Herod, specifically, that's referring to Herod the Great. And if you know anything about history, Herod was not exactly great. He wasn't great as you and I would think of greatness. He was not a good guy. He was anything but a good guy. He was a little psychotic, actually, and extremely crazy and paranoid. But he was great in the sense that he built great buildings. He advanced economically, and the society moved it forward. He really was known by the great works of architecture that he built. That's why he's referred predominantly as Herod the Great. So it's the days of Herod the Great, and in his reign over at Judea, we meet Zechariah and Elizabeth. And here's what we know about them. Their names alone are extremely important because both of their names have meaning attached to it, which also was very common in their day. For example, Elizabeth's name meant literally God's oath, right? God's oath. God made a promise. And remember, every time you hear your name, Elizabeth, that God is a God of promises, that God makes oaths. He makes promises, and he keeps those promises. That's what her name means. It's kind of a cool little thing to think. Every time you hear your name spoken, God promises. God's oath. God is faithful, in other words. Zechariah, his name meant the Lord remembers. Right? And so Elizabeth, we read a minute ago, that she's from the line of Aaron, which are referred to as the Levites. They're kind of the really, really, really big deal priests in the history of the kingdom of Israel. You can think of them that way, all right? So that's kind of her lineage. That's where she comes from. That's her family. So she's got some prestige attached to her name, right? God's oath. And then here comes Zechariah, and Zechariah is a priest, a little different. He's not from the line of Aaron. At least it doesn't say that, right? So, but he is still a priest, and he's probably not a very big deal priest. In fact, we know where they live is not a really big town. It's not a really big place. The synagogue or wherever where he would have served was not a really big place at all. Right, so when you think about where they lived, they probably lived in this little town of 50 or 100 or a couple of hundred people. All right, they lived in a city that would have made Groveland or Montverde look like a metropolitan big city. Right, it's not a really big place they live. And the synagogue where he served as priest, you might have 10, 15, 20 people show up. It's not a really big thing. In fact, he's not a really big deal priest as most people would have thought in their day about priests. And here's what we know about this couple whose names mean God's oath and the Lord remembers. Here's what we know about them. Number one, they're old, right? We read that. They are advanced in years. We don't know exactly how old, but the history that we do know and the circumstances we do know about, they would not have referred to Zechariah as being old until he was most likely past the age when most of the Levites would have retired, which was 50. So the most general accepted idea is he's probably around 60, maybe 70 years old, which in that culture was extremely old. They didn't live quite as long as we tend to live today. So he's old. He's been around a day or two, all right? The second thing we know about him is that they're barren, meaning that Elizabeth could not have children. And that is extremely important in that culture because without children, not only did you not have help around your house and help economically, in that day, children added to the economic feasibility of a family versus cost you a couple hundred grand to raise a kid by the time they're done today. I'm waiting to send my kids that bill one day, right? By the way, I've added up everything I spent on you from birth through 24. You can make payments, right? I'm thinking that's a good thing, right? But anyway, back then, no, it wasn't that way. They actually added economic viability to the family. It was like they worked and helped provide for the family. They had no children, so that was a struggle. And on top of that, when they themselves became old, there was no one to take care of them. And if you had no children, and especially no male children in that culture, in that society, you were kind of in trouble one day when it came to taking care of yourself. So they're old, they're barren, and the third thing we know about them, they are poor. They're poor. They're not big deal priests. Remember, he's probably in what we would consider a bivocational priest, very likely. He's kind of trying, he doesn't get paid a lot of money by what he does in the tabernacle there in that small little town. And so here you have this couple named God's Oath and the Lord Remembers, who for 40 or 50 years of their married life have been praying that God would give them a child. No, he has not answered that prayer. They're serving in the small little town with very few people. The role that he serves as a priest, it's not all that impressive. It's not all that big deal in the eyes of the religious culture of their day. This is Zechariah, all right? So anyway you say it, I'm not trying to be mean, but it's just blunt, and this is the truth. He's not all that big deal impressive of a guy in their society. And you know what's surprising to me? This guy makes the Bible. I mean, think about that. Of all the people in this day and age, of all the people God could have inspired Luke to include in his narrative of the life of Christ, who does he include? He includes the story of a guy who doesn't really have a lot of high position, doesn't have a lot of notoriety, doesn't do a lot of really big stuff. He's just an average guy trying to love God and walk blamelessly before him, who's old, barren, and poor. And you know why I think God includes him in the story? Well, obviously there's a specific reason we'll get to in a minute, but here's one of the reasons. Because the things that impress us are really not generally the things that impress God. In fact, the Bible even says that. Man looks at the outward appearance. God looks at the heart. God was doing something different in the life of Zechariah than maybe no one could see at the time. Look at verse 8. Here's what it goes on to say. Now, while he, Zechariah, was serving as priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. So let me explain what that means, because this is really important to the story. At this time, there were thousands and thousands of priests in Judea. And the way they would organize themselves, they were divided up into 24 divisions, each of those divisions getting their rotating opportunity to go to Jerusalem and to oversee and be responsible for the ministry of the temple in Jerusalem. And that was a really big deal. I mean, this was like where everybody believed this is where the presence of God was. This is where the Ark of the Covenant was, which represented the presence of God and the Holy of Holies interacting with the people. And so every so often you would rotate through, right? So a couple of times a year, your division's going to rotate through and be responsible for Jerusalem and the ministry of the temple. And when you showed up there, the way they decided which of the priests in that division would specifically do certain things is they would roll the dice. It was like Vegas for priests, all right? So they would kind of roll some dice and, all right, hey, the lot fell to you, you get to do this. The lot fell to you, you get to do that. And at this point in the story, probably, quite possibly, for the very first time in his life, the lot falls to Zechariah, and he gets to walk in and burn incense at the altar of God in the temple. And that might not mean a lot to you, but it meant a lot to them. It was a really big moment, all right? In priest world, in Zechariah's day, it's like the Super Bowl. This is the moment. This is one of the things I've been waiting for the opportunity to do. I get to walk into the temple. I get to walk in and lay incense on the altar and make prayers to God on behalf of the people. It's a big moment for him. And he walks in, and here's what it says that happens as he walks in. Look at verse 8. Now, while he was serving as priest before God, his division was on duty according to the custom of the priesthood. He was chosen by lot to enter the temple and burn incense. Then verse 11. We don't know what he prayed for exactly, but we know that he prayed at least some things. Here's what he said, verse 11. And there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. So Zechariah, it's his one moment. He walks in. He walks into this room, and he begins to burn incense on the altar, and he begins to pray. And again, we don't know exactly what he prayed for. He probably prayed, as they always actually were supposed to do, prayed on behalf of the sins of the people, prayed for forgiveness for the sins of the people. They would pray for the people. Quite possibly, Zechariah prayed that God would deliver Judea from Rome, because they were occupied by the Roman Empire. That's very likely what he was praying. And apparently, Zechariah also prays for he and Elizabeth once more to have a child. And we know that because of what comes next. But here, he's standing in this room, in the altar. This angel shows up, and Zechariah, when he sees him, he's afraid, right? Fear fell upon him. Now, I do think it's important to make that note, because this is just a little side note. 2,000 years ago, when an angel showed up and talked to you, it was as big of a deal as it would be today, all right? It didn't happen all the time. I think sometimes we read these stories in the Bible, and we just kind of imagine that this was normal, right? Like a priest would walk in, and an angel would show up, and they'd have a conversation. Or it was normal for a bush to catch on fire, and God speak through this bush, but the bush not burn up. I think we think it's normal sometimes that God would speak through a donkey to somebody and have a conversation. Those stories that we read, and if you've been around faith a long time, you've read those stories and heard sermons and Sunday school lessons and small group studies on those stories, and we just almost, I think, kind of associate that God did that kind of stuff all the time, but he didn't. He did occasionally, but not very often. And so this has never, ever happened to Zechariah before. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say he's probably never even heard of this happening to anybody he knows ever before. Walking into the temple, praying, and an angel show up and have a conversation with you. And so he's scared. And here's what the angel says, verse 13. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, For your prayer has been heard, and your wife will bear you a son, and you will call his name John. And here's what the angel says that John will do. Look at verse 16. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. You're going to have a child. You're going to call him John. And it's a very unique story that God's going to write in John's life, and not only the nation of Israel, but in the nation, in the story of all humanity. But John is going to turn many people from their sin. And at the end of verse 17, he tells us why. Look at the end of verse 17. To make ready for the Lord a people prepared. God's heard your prayer. You've been praying all these years for a child. God's heard it. I'm here to tell you, God heard your prayer. You're going to have a son. Call him John. He's going to say, turn many from their sins, and he's going to help people be prepared for the Lord. We know specifically now what Luke is saying, referring to, or what the angel is referring to that Luke writes down, and that is that John would become John the Baptist, the predecessor, the guy that came before Jesus announcing and proclaiming that the kingdom of God had come. This is Zechariah's story, and Zechariah is no one from nowhere in the eyes of the world. He's a small town priest getting to do something for the very first time that he had dreamt his whole life he'd be able to do. And God says to him, I heard your prayers. Here comes your son. Your son will be grace to you. Your son will be great in the sight of God, because this son, we know, again, would be John the Baptist. And he would come announcing the coming of Jesus that the prophets had foretold all those years. Can you imagine being Zechariah in that moment? I mean, really, can you imagine being Zechariah? Can you imagine what he would feel, how he would think, what he would be experiencing? Can you imagine being that? You know, what's interesting to me is over the years, I've had people tell me, I can't tell you how many times this has happened to me. I've been talking with someone who's been praying or trying to decide what they should do, or been waiting on God to answer some prayer, or just confused about something they're praying about. And they would say to me, you know, Brian, you know what I wish? I wish God would just audibly tell me what I'm supposed to do, and then I would go do it. Like, if God would just, in a real, tangible voice, say, hey, go do this, or hey, this is what the answer is. Man, it would be so easy to obey God. No, it wouldn't. You know what we would do? I think you and I would do exactly what Zechariah does. And look at what he does. Look at verse 18. And Zechariah said to the angel, how shall I know this? How shall I know what? How shall he know that he's going to have a son? Now, back up and think about this. What's just happened? Zechariah, for 40, 50, 60 years, has been praying with his wife, God bless us with a child. It's the day that he shows up. His division is on duty in the temple. It's the one time the lot fell to him. Zechariah is in the temple. He's offering a prayer. He's burning incense. He's praying to God. He prays for the people. He prays for their sins. He prays for Israel to be delivered. And oh yeah, God, and also just one more time, you know, could I get a son? And right after that, an angel shows up and says, yes, you can. And what's Zechariah's response? How can I be sure you're really going to do that, God? And can't you imagine the angel being like, oh, well, let's review all this one more time, right? You're here, the roll of the dice, I'm here. In fact, he even says, look what the angel says in verse 19. The angel answered him, I'm Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. I was sent to speak to you and bring you this good news. And can't you imagine Zechariah going, oh yeah, I mean, well, there's that. I mean, but even so, how will I know? How will I know? How can I be sure? Because we laugh at that guy, and we probably should, but you and I would respond the exact same way. How do you know that God's really going to do what he says he's going to do? Because the longer we live life, all of a sudden life is no longer just about wish lists and waiting. It's about all the wishes and prayers and hopes that we were waiting on God for that never really panned out exactly the way we thought they would, or this thing we were sure and convinced God wanted us to do, and it kind of turned out bad, and it kind of went south. And so being confident and wishing and waiting and praying and hoping, before long, life just kind of clouds and confuses and distorts that hope, and it becomes a lot harder to say, God, I get it, and I believe. I mean, we find ourselves waiting on God to do things all the time. And sometimes as we're waiting, maybe we begin to think, you know, oh, was I wrong? Was God's wrong? Was God making and keeping promises something that really only happened back then? Does it still happen now? Is God mad at me? Has God forgotten me? Should I even be asking for this? I mean, moments of doubt, they raise their head in all of us. And over time, it's not just Christmas that gets a little more complicated. It's our faith in following Jesus that gets a little more complicated because life clouds what we once were absolutely convinced of. We'll at some point find ourselves not quite so sure what we once knew to be true. Because it's just a little hard. See, there are moments when it's difficult, very, very difficult as a follower of Jesus to see what God's doing. Wouldn't you agree? And we all have those moments, and maybe this is a season like that for you. And if I could encourage you with anything, like how do you move forward? How do you keep trusting God in a season where, you know, I used to believe God, but I'm struggling to still believe God, or I used to walk very closely with God, and he just feels kind of distant and far from me right now. I used to be able to pray, and now I'm having trouble praying, and whatever that might be for you. In those moments where it's really hard to see God, here's what I found that tends to be an encouragement for me, and I hope it is for you. It's this, that when it's difficult to see God today, remember how you saw God yesterday. See, sometimes today is difficult to see God. It might be tomorrow, might be 4 days from now, might be 2 months from now or a year from now, but there will be that today, whenever today is, that it's just kind of hard to see God in it. When it's hard to see God today, remember how you saw God yesterday. Because when I turn around and I look over the last 45, almost 46 years of my life, you know what I see? If I really want to pay attention and I really want to look closely, I see example after example after example of God being faithful when I didn't deserve him to be faithful. I see example after example of God doing something that I didn't know he was doing. And God fulfilling a promise in a way that I never would have imagined he would fulfill it. Or God being at work in a way that I couldn't see in the moment. And I turn around and I look behind me and I can remember, I remember that day. When the day just felt really dark and the clouds were thick. And then I remember 2 days later or the next season, I remember what God did. I also can look around this room and story after story in this room of the exact same thing, how God's been faithful to you. How God's done things that you never would imagine that he was going to do. In those moments, in those days where it's hard to see God, remember how you saw him yesterday, and it helps you to see him today. And so here's how we're going to end today, and it's going to take a few minutes to do this. But I want to end today, spending the next several minutes just reading through some promises of God. Because one thing I cannot do, I wish I could, I wish I had this magic preacher wand, that in those moments where it's hard to see God today, that I could just kind of wave it and the clouds would part and you'd be like, even if it was just for a minute, like, oh, there he is. Okay. And then the clouds are back. All right. I can keep going. Like, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do that for you. I wish I could do that for me sometimes. Doesn't quite work like that. But you know what I found that does kind of part the clouds and help you to see God when you're having trouble seeing him? The way you remember how he worked yesterday is to remember what his promises say about what he's going to do. So what I thought I'd do is I just want to read three different passages that talk in some form or fashion about what God has promised he will do. And my hope is, as I read these, that it would give just a little encouragement and a little hope and a little clarity, especially if you're here and you're in that moment where it's just kind of difficult to see and hear and believe and trust, maybe even follow Jesus. And I want to start with how the story of Zechariah and Elizabeth ends in chapter 1. Then in verse 57 and 58, here's what it says at the end of their story. Actually, their story goes on, but here's what it says at the end of this chapter. Now the time came for Elizabeth to give birth, and she bore a son. And her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced with her. The time came. Can I be honest with you? I hate that phrase. I do. Here's what I hate about it. I hate it and love it. Here's what I hate about it. It tells me that God's time is probably rarely going to be mine. It tells me that there's going to be things that I'm waiting and wishing and hoping and praying and almost in my own mind demanding, God, you need to do this. Here's the answer. God, this is what I need. And God's going, yeah, but you know, it's not the time. But when the time comes, God will. And so as much on the one hand as I hate those three words, I absolutely love those three words. The time came, she bore a son. And she bore a son when the time came in a way that was evident to everybody of what? That the Lord had shown great mercy. And what did it lead to? They got to rejoice with her that the Lord had shown great mercy to her. Because when the time came, God's oath was fulfilled and the Lord remembered. I want to read from Colossians chapter 2, the words of the Apostle Paul. I love this passage in Colossians because of what it speaks to what God has done inside of each of us so that we can be called his children. Here's what it says. God made you alive with Christ. Ever had a day where you didn't quite feel as alive as maybe you used to? I mean, maybe you're here this morning and maybe there's a dream that's kind of dying, or maybe there's a relationship that's kind of dying, or maybe there's a plan or a desire, or a dream you had for your child that kind of seems to be fading. I mean, there's times that life just feels like the things that are good are kind of dying in us. And this promise is this, that God makes you alive with Christ. And you know how he does that? By forgiving all of our sins, having canceled the written code that stood opposed to us, he took it away and nailed it to the cross. Now that language kind of sounds weird, but the Bible uses this language many different times. And what it's referring to is this idea of almost a courtroom. That you and I before God, it's as if we stood before God in a court of law. If we were, there would be this long decree, this long record of everything you and I have ever done wrong. There's a very clear record of our sin that exists before God that says that you and I deserve nothing but his judgment. And Jesus took that. This is amazing imagery. He took it, and he took it to the cross, and he nailed it on the cross with himself, and when he did, he destroyed it. So that now when you stand before God, there is no evidence of guilt because Jesus took it, and he destroyed it. And through faith, he forgives you, and you stand before God forgiven. God made you alive. And Jesus said these words, recorded in Matthew. It's an invitation. He said, so come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. I am gentle. I am humble in heart. You'll find rest for your souls. So this morning, before we conclude and the team comes and leads us in one last song this morning, I want to end by praying. And I want to pray for you, and especially for those of you that might find yourself in this season, a moment a day when it's just a little cloudy, it's a little dark, and you're just kind of having a little trouble seeing God. If that's you, I want you to hear this. You're not the only one. You're not alone. God knows. We've been there. And if you're having trouble seeing God today, remember how you saw him yesterday. And I want to pray for you that maybe that could be true, that you could begin to see how he was at work yesterday to see him more clearly today. So I want to ask you to bow your heads, and I want to have a time of prayer. And as your heads are bowed, I would just ask if you feel like that is you, if you're just in that moment where life's just a little darker than it used to be, and it's a little more difficult to clearly see God than maybe it used to be. If you're having trouble seeing him today, and would you just maybe slip up your hand so I can just pray for you? Okay. And if you're here this morning and your hand's not raised, and maybe today's a season where life is really, really good, celebrate and rejoice and thank God for his goodness. And as you do, maybe pray for someone who's not in that place right now. Let's pray together as a church family. Father, on this time of the year that we try our best to slow down so that we can see you clearly. Life seems to speed up. Sometimes it's really hard to see all that you are and all that you promised and all that you're doing. Because life really is more than just wish lists. Life is life. And sometimes it's hard to see you and trust you and follow you. So God, I pray for those in here this morning that are saying that is where they are today. It's just kind of hard to see you clearly. God, that your mercy would fall upon them. The truth of your son, Jesus, would encourage them, would bring them peace. And even if today they can't see you at all, God, help them to maybe look in the rearview mirror and remember how they saw you in the past. And remember the stories of how you have been at work in their life, that they could find encouragement and hope to put one foot in front of the other and keep walking towards you. God, thank you that your son is light and you invite us into the light. Thank you through Jesus you have given us grace and forgiveness and hope. Thank you for being a God filled with promises. It's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.